How's this for an outrageous plot line? A rogue nation with a billion-dollar crime syndicate pays for its nuclear-tipped long-range missiles by laundering counterfeit bills, in part through Las Vegas slot machines. No, it's not the plot of a James Bond film. It's the very real North Korea. On today's underreported segment, we take a look at North Korea's elusive Office 39 with Vanity Fair contributing editor David Rose. His article, North Korea's Dollar Store, appears in the September issue of the magazine and can also be read online. We have linked to the article on our show page at WNYC.org, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Rose back to our program today. Hello.
Always a pleasure, then. How are you doing?
I'm okay. You're speaking to us from the north of Scotland on vacation?
Yes, I'm with my daughters. We're hiking in the very far north of Scotland, and I'm on a campsite in Ullapool. So if you hear any strange background noises, it's a lot of people enjoying themselves up in the mountains here, and the weather's pretty decent, so we're lucky.
What is Office 39, and what is its official role in the North Korean government?
Well, Office 39's official role is to manage the finances of Kim Jong-il, the North Korean dictator. But as well as doing that, as well as helping him salt who knows how many millions or billions away in Swiss bank accounts, it also runs perhaps the world's most successful and maybe even the world's biggest organized crime syndicate. It is responsible for the supply of much of the narcotics sold in the Far East, in Japan, in China. Believe it or not, they're actually exporting opium and heroin to China, which is a bit like the old British saying, exporting coal to Newcastle. They're also involved in all kinds of frauds. For example, the big thing recently is reinsurance fraud. But perhaps of most interest to the United States is the fact that Office 39 is believed and indeed has been proven to be behind an extraordinary counterfeiting operation that goes back well over 20 years and makes so-called supernotes, the most accurate forgeries of U.S. $100 bills in existence, forgeries that are literally almost undetectable, so that you can, as you mentioned in your intro, pass them in large quantities in Las Vegas, where, of course, the machines are supposedly equipped with pretty good detectors. And they are manufacturing $100 bills that are so good that they are almost exact copies of the real thing.
Now, why U.S. $100 supernotes and not euros or British pounds?
Well, I suppose because despite the buffeting of the world economy and the credit crunch and all that, you know, if the world has a reserve currency, it is still the U.S. dollar. And, you know, there are more U.S. dollars in circulation by a very long way than any other currency. I suppose, you know, conceivably that might change. But for now, that's what they're interested in. And of course, the other thing, which I should have said before, is that, you know, why are they doing this? They're doing this because their own legitimate economy has been and is on its knees, and that's the way it's been for a very long time. But yet, they're managing to build these extraordinary new missiles, the long-range missile that they tested recently, the short and medium-range missiles that are already functioning very effectively, which have been modified so that they could carry nuclear warheads. And of course, as we all know, earlier this year, they carried out their second underground nuclear weapons test. So,
all paid for by Office 39?
The organized crime syndicate run by Office 39.
Now, we're talking about one of the most secretive regimes in the world. How do we even know that Office 39 exists?
Well, we know principally because over the years there has been a pretty constant trickle, indeed sometimes more than a trickle, of defectors from the North Korean regime. And some of them have defected from a pretty high level. And, you know, everything that they say checks out with each other. You know, we're not talking about a situation here like the famous Iraqi WMD. And, you know, one of the people I interviewed for the article is Seung Jae Park, who's personally debriefed more than 1,000 defectors, including the guy who was once Kim Jong-il's personal ideological tutor, people who were, you know, in the Politburo at a very high level in the regime. And they're all saying the same thing. And, you know, they're pointing to the same buildings on satellite photographs. You know, there's any amount kind of collateral corroborating information that comes from people who, of course, are captured by law enforcement in different countries. It's a pretty consistent picture.
Well, isn't North Korea so dysfunctional it can't manufacture a decent automobile? How is it capable of even acquiring the special presses necessary to print U.S. currency and raw materials for the paper like American cotton?
Well, that's a very good question because they are using paper that is effectively identical to paper used by the Bureau of Engraving to print the real thing. As you say, it's using cotton from the American South and fractions of other cotton, just like the real thing. And they're using this intaglio printing process. Very few places in the world make intaglio presses. And they're also using the optical variable ink, which changes color according to the angle on which you look at a bill from, which, of course, real $100 bills have had for some time now. And indeed, you know, it does raise this question. Well, why can't they build automobiles? Of course, they could build automobiles. They could build, you know, probably computers and all kinds of things, just like the South Koreans. I think maybe, and Seung Jae Park, this very senior Korean intelligence analyst, his idea is that, his theory is that it has something very much to do with the very nature of the regime, this ideology which is known in Korean as juche, which means something like self-reliance, but it also means something more. It's not just we can be independent, we can be self-reliant, we can do things our own way. There is also very much an attitude of, well, I won't use the appropriate profanity, but we all know the word, and the phrase begins with a four-letter word and ends with you. That is their attitude, because, you know, by making counterfeit currency, you don't just finance your nuclear weapon missile programs. You also, of course, damage the interests of the United States. You damage capitalist economies, which depend on U.S. dollars or use U.S. dollars in large quantities. So it has a kind of dual purpose here. And that's the best answer that Seung Jae Park comes up with, and it seems pretty credible to me.
It's the same thing that the Nazi Germany tried to do. They had a similar plan to counterfeit foreign policy during World War II to undermine their enemies. But how do the economics of this work? Does the North Korean government just print counterfeit U.S. money and spend it around the globe, or do the bills need to be traded for legitimate currency?
Well, they seem to do a variety of things. I mean, one of the things that happened a few years ago is they were using a network of banks to launder this. They were distributing counterfeit dollars through the international banking network. And, of course, that was getting into circulation in a variety of places. The other thing that they do, and they do this with drugs, for example, as well, is that they make use of organized crime networks. They have contacts with, for example, the Japanese Yakuza syndicates, with the Russian mafia, with Chinese mafias, especially ones from Taiwan. Their relationships with Taiwanese criminals appear to be particularly close. So they have a variety of different ways in which to get this stuff out.
Now, when you say Kim Jong-il has billions of dollars stashed in bank accounts in Switzerland, are they real dollars or is counterfeits?
That's a good question, too. I guess they started out, who knows? I mean, if you have bills that are hard to detect, though, of course, you know, experts can, then you may get caught if you try to pass them. But one of the things that people think that the North Koreans do is they deliberately make a couple of tiny flaws in the supernotes and the counterfeits so that they can detect their own forgeries. I mean, these counterfeits are so good that micro-printed features on $100 bills, which are 1/40,000 of an inch high, in other words, completely invisible to the naked eye, are reproduced exactly on the supernote. And yet, there are two or three mistakes, and exactly what those mistakes are is a closely guarded secret. You know, the Secret Service knows, but I don't. Why do they make those mistakes? It's so they can tell if criminal gangs are buying their supernotes at maybe 30 cents on the dollar. They want to make sure that they're not getting ripped off with supernotes when they're selling supernotes. What they want is real dollars. So I think Kim Jong-il probably is depositing the real dollars he's getting from the sale of supernotes and other criminal activity, but he's making sure he can tell the difference.
My guest is David Rose, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. We're talking about North Korea's counterfeiting operation on today's Underreported. Let's talk about the laundering. Who is Chen Chang-Liu, who also goes by the name Wilson?
Well, Chen Chang-Liu is a Taiwanese businessman, or ostensibly a businessman, who has had connections with North Korea for a very long time. I managed to interview him in the cell in the federal jailhouse in Las Vegas earlier this year when he was awaiting sentencing. And he told me that he'd been doing business in North Korea for 15 years, and he insisted, as of course he would, that most of his business was legitimate. He told me that he had a business at the time importing leather handbags from North Korea, and he also ran a bus service. But his main thing was supernotes. And as the FBI managed to prove by having an agent listen to him in a hotel in California, in the Ritz-Carlton in Pasadena, he boasted that he had extremely good connections with the North Koreans, and he could get hold of any amount of supernotes as you could possibly want. And he said they're so good, they'll even get through the machines in Vegas. Now, the bizarre thing is that his hobby, the way he liked to spend his weekends, was actually to spend supernotes himself with his family in Vegas. Purely, I guess, to make a profit, but also to have fun. And they were seen by a number of the biggest hotels and casinos in Vegas as very high rollers. So they had comps. They had, you know, free food and lodging in Bellagio and Caesars Palace and some of the MGM places as well. He was eventually, of course, caught in Caesars Palace. But, you know, his gaming card showed that he had laundered literally millions and millions of dollars in just a few months. But he'd been going to Vegas every weekend for years. One has to assume that, you know, he had managed to dispose of perhaps tens of millions of supernotes in Vegas over that period.
And he admits to links with the North Korean government?
No, you see, he's one of these guys who is he does have links with the North Korean government, but he's not in any sense a government agent himself. I mean, he's a kind of mid criminal. Well, with other mid, somehow he's selling supernotes to other criminal networks in the U.S. He was eventually caught trying to do that as well. He's buying this stuff from his contacts who are working for Office 39, the criminal kind of department in the North Korean government. Exactly how that worked, we just don't know, because I thought one of the most interesting things in my interview with him is that, you know, he talked a great deal about how he was going to miss his family, how he loved his daughters, how he tried to bring them up to have decent values and all this. It was all very touching. I said, well, why didn't you make a deal? Why didn't you give up what you know about it, how exactly this process works, who your contacts are? And I've never seen a man more terrified. He just looked at me with utter horror on his face, and he said, you know, he said, I have very good connections with the North Koreans. He said, the North Koreans are my friends. If I ever get out of here, I will hang out with them again. He said, but I cannot betray them. If you betray the North Koreans, they have the most terrible prison. It will be the end of my life, and there is nowhere in the world that the FBI can protect me. I could not betray them.
You've also talked about the Golden Star Bank in Vienna being involved in the Banco Delta Asia in Monaco. The U.S. government was in the final stage of its plans in regards to this investigation during the Bush administration. What happened?
Yeah, I should correct you there. Sorry, it was Macau, not Monaco. Yes, I mean, there had been set up late 2002, early 2003, an extraordinarily successful interagency program known as the Illicit Activities Initiative. And the guy who was in charge of it was somebody I interviewed extensively for the article, David Asher. Who's now gone back to the private sector. And he put together this remarkable team from the U.S. Secret Service, from the FBI, from the State Department, from the Treasury Department, from the Department of Justice. And, you know, often these interagency operations in the U.S. And indeed in any country, you know, they fall foul of turf wars, territorial rivalries, that kind of thing. But this operation seems to have been a remarkable enterprise. And they really had them nailed. I mean, they had... they were pretty close to drawing up indictments that would have gone to the top of the North Korean regime. They could have shut down Office 39's activities, and they could have made North Korea simply radioactive for any kind of international legitimate business. They could have hurt them very, very badly.
Well, David, we have very little time, but why did they shut it down? Why did they shut down the investigation, kill the investigation?
Well, it seems to have been, as another person I interviewed, Suzanne Hayden, who was in charge of the Department of Justice, as she put it, the diplomatic part of this just came swooping in. And, you know, North Korea had already had one nuclear weapons test. The U.S. was understandably very concerned about this. They were desperate to get them back to the negotiating table in the so-called six-party talks involving the U.S. and four other nations with the North Koreans to try and stop their nuclear weapons program. And so, you know, the North Koreans have played this remarkable game for a number of years now. It's kind of, you know, excuse the cliche, but it's cat and mouse. They will appear to transgress, they will push the envelope, and they'll get slapped on the wrist, and then they'll withdraw, and they'll say, we'll never do it again. They'll apologize, and they'll say, yes, engage with us. You'll see that we're really not such bad guys.
So, David, the counterfeiting obviously continues.
And that's what's happened.
And I assume that Bill Clinton came back with a couple of $100 bills. David Rose is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and he's written about the North Korean counterfeiting operation in the current issue of the magazine. Thank you so much for being on our underreported segment today.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. It's been a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, we take a look at how technology is changing music with Moby and Wall Street Journal columnist Walter Mossberg. Then Anthony Flint looks back on how Jane Jacobs' epic struggle with Robert Moses changed the way we think about the American city. Plus, Please Explain is about dying languages. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Miranda Schaefer. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow. We'll be right back.